when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shack of a sauce bottle, mate.
G'day and welcome to another Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University. I'm, of course, Mark Kenny. And can I start by just paying tribute to the life and contribution of former Labor leader, opposition leader from 2001 to 2003, Simon Crean, who sadly died very suddenly whilst travelling in Germany just in the last few days. And a real shock to the Australian community, the Australian political community, the Labor Party, and of course, not least his family and those close to him. Crean was a highly respected figure, and there have been tributes coming from a number of different directions, including from the other side of politics. And my colleagues here on the podcast may have some things they want to say to that in a moment as well. Joining me, as I say, is my colleague and friend, Dr. Maria Teflaga, who's with us each week, a political scientist, senior lecturer in the School of Politics and International Relations. Hi, Maria.
Hello, Mark. Hi, everyone.
It was a sad thing, really, wasn't it, to hear of Simon Crean's passing? I suppose some younger listeners will be less aware of who he was. Things moved pretty quickly, and he departed politics, really, I think, in the early part of the previous decade, as Labor kind of went through the final dramatic stages of what was really a decade of instability and meltdowns.
That's right. And if anything, actually, the start of his leadership might have been the sort of first act of that decade of instability. Yeah.
In fact, I have a piece on The Conversation making that very point, that it did feel to me like, looking at it in hindsight, that he was the first domino to fall, really, and he became the first Labor leader not to, to be denied the chance of fighting an election as Labor leader, to be put in place and then denied a chance to contest an election. And the leaders he was replaced by, there was a whole series of similar kind of ructions. He was replaced by Mark Latham, one of the more curious decisions in Australian political history, and of course disastrous in electoral terms. And then Beazley came back for like a third crack at it. He didn't get a third crack at it because he was replaced by Rudd. Rudd didn't then get a chance to fight the election as a sitting prime minister because he was replaced by Gillard, who was not given a chance to fight a subsequent election other than the one she had to fight pretty well immediately once she took over the leadership because Rudd came back. And things didn't settle down in the Labor Party really until they were in opposition and everyone kind of lined up in a row behind Bill Shorten.
That's right. It basically took Labor a decade to learn that lesson.
To relearn what they'd learnt before. Also with us is David Spears, of course, host of Insiders, former Press Gallery Journalist of the Year and numerous other accolades that I could apply to him. Welcome, Dave. Welcome back, I should say.
Thank you both very much. Great to be here.
And joining us also is Senator Barbara Pocock, a Green Senator from South Australia, an interrogator extraordinaire of PwC in the scandal that's been running now for a little while. Welcome also back to you, Barbara, because you've been on here before as well.
I have, and it's great to be back, Mark. Good to be here.
Any reflections anyone else wanted to make about Simon Crean just before we kick off on other matters?
Yeah, look, I was in the gallery covering Simon Crean's leadership from start to finish. Really sad moment this week and quite a shock. I remember him as interviewed him many, many times, a serious figure in politics, someone who had grown up, of course, in politics, given his father's role. His life had been about getting to that point. You know, I remember going on trade delegation trips with him as trade minister to India and Shanghai, and he loved that aspect of the work as well. And I remember going to places with Simon Crean back then. But, I mean, a lot of focus this week, I think, rightly, on the moral courage he showed on the Iraq War in opposing that.
Yeah.
A lot's been said about that. I'd also note he took on a couple of other courageous battles. One was internal in the Labor Party to reduce the union control over the Labor Party from 60-40 to 50-50.
Yeah, and that was really significant because he came from the union movement.
He came from the ACTU.
Former head of the Stormont and Packers Union, and then he was president of the ACTU. His bona fides were very sort of union-based, much more so than, say, Albanese, who's there now.
Well, that's right. And reducing the union influence in the Labor conference to 50-50 rather than 60-40 did cost him some
They
support.
Came for him. Let's be honest.
And
they now, came now, for
yeah,
him.
And look at where things ended up. Also, the 40-40-20 quotas as well happened at that special Labor conference for getting more women into Parliament. We see the benefits of that now in Labor. So, yeah, there's a lot of things he did. Obviously, he didn't cut through or appeal enough, whatever the word you want to use is, in terms of a leader. And you touched on the train of leadership chaos that followed. I think it's right to say, certainly in my view, that the seeds of Labor's failure in government under Rudd and Gillard really sit in that period where they started to churn through Crean, Beazley, Latham. And Crean was in large part responsible for getting the numbers for Mark Latham to become leader and blocking Kim Beazley. So, yes, all of that was a problem that then we saw play out when they finally did get to government. That culture of churning through leaders was the real problem for them. But, look, he did a lot of good internally and as a minister publicly as well.
And then afterwards as well, he really continued that sort of international representation role. I certainly met him a few times in places abroad. When he was carrying out capacities as I think he was chair of the Australia-Europe Business Council. Or Europe-Australia Business Council, I think it's called. Barbara, any thoughts?
Well, I've been reflecting on the high price that people pay, in living a life of political public contribution. I really feel for his family there to lose him at 74, having, given probably a lot as a family to public life. Often people look to, those years of retirement or a bit slower time together and in your community with your family. So, that's what I've been thinking about, and clearly a real loss for his community and his family.
Yeah, absolutely. And I might just say, on a personal note, I really liked him. I mean, he was always good-natured, always up for a laugh, very respectful.
Yeah, one of those policies, and there are some but not all, who you can do a really tough interview with, but they respect it. They respect your role as a journalist. They respect what they're doing, and you can get on with it and still have, good dialogue.
Yeah.
Oh, a professional.
They do exist.
Well, it matters because it is the machine that you're part of, and journalists have a role to play, and it's not about, ducking the issues or playing favourites on the basis of kind of personal affections or whatever. So let that be a lesson to you, Barbara Pocock, with what's coming next.
Thanks, Mark.
On that,
go hard.
Though, yeah, okay. Well, let me go hard with this penetrating question to you. The PwC scandal, just give us a sort of a postage stamp size explanation of how this came about, because you've played this very prominent role sitting there in Senate Estimates Committees probing this. And I just wonder if you could just explain the sort of background of this, how it came about.
Well, I guess the key thing that has really given this momentum is the very corrupt set of events where people within the tax branch of PwC, which is a very large entity, were consulted around changes to our multinational tax avoidance arrangements. They were asked, as people who knew how big companies avoided tax, to advise on how to make it work properly.
Yeah, just to advise the government, right?
To advise the government. Through inside Treasury. And this particular character, Peter Collins, signed three confidentiality agreements with Treasury between 2013 and 2018 and proceeded to harvest that information with very large multinational clients and build the client base of PwC and earn fees by selling that information, essentially. So very traitorous act. And one that has become, this was 8 years ago that it occurred, but it's taken a long time for the consequences for the mechanics of this failure to emerge. And it's clear that there was a failure not only in that first instance of ethical practice, but clearly a failure of management and an internal problem across this very large organisation with over 9,000 employees, 900 partners, a massive corporate fail, a case study in how not to do something in the first instance and then not how to not deal with it properly in the years since, especially in recent months.
Yeah, so it's like essentially getting paid by the government to advise on the most effective ways
of... They donated that time. They weren't paid for it. It was
They donated that time.
Yes, it was as I understand it, it was, come and advise us about how this works, which is, something, a much prized opportunity for people who are inside big consultancies, because many of them will use the fact that they are used by government in that way as a positive attribute.
Right, okay.
And that's an important point, isn't it? Mm. It wasn't a contract per se to give that advice. They were just called in because of their expertise to advise.
And avoiding tax.
Do we know? I know the pursuit of all of this is still ongoing, Senator, but Peter Collins, you mentioned there. What about the others, the culpability? Do we know much about, can you give us a sense yet about how many others and what they did, what the wrongdoing entails as far as you're aware at the moment?
Well, I've read what really brought this to the fore was the release of email exchanges between PwC partners and employees as they monetized this information amongst their clients' base. And tax tried pretty hard. Once they knew within 24 hours of the changes in tax being announced in the budget in 2015, they knew that something was afoot. They didn't know instantly, actually, but immediately the tax changes were announced by Joe Hockey. The next day, PwC went to work amongst its clients list and emailed out, we can help you with this.
Just to be clear, we can help you find ways to get around this new fence.
We've got a workaround for this. Yeah. And they made $2.5 million out of that workaround offer, at least, probably more. And over time, tax became aware this is happening way too quickly. What's going on here? And they were unable, because PwC incredibly aggressively used professional legal privilege to prevent the tax office from getting to the facts of the matter. They did that with tens of thousands of claims of professional legal privilege, which means, their legal counsel clearly and many senior managers are involved in a set of decisions and a strategy around this item. So you're asking, David, who was involved? Well, many people were, obviously many partners, and these email exchanges, which are redacted in terms of who was receiving or sending the email, show there are a lot of people involved in PwC, and there's a lot of information emerging. I'm getting whistleblower emails every day from people within PwC and the other big four, naming people, and it's clearly a real odour across the senior management of PwC.
It seems like there was a real kind of, you mentioned there were a lot of people involved. I mean, that in itself speaks to a sort of a looseness, a kind of almost a sort of a cavalier nature of the way this privileged information is being used. I mean, people are almost boasting to each other about the fact that they've got this inside knowledge and are able then to, as you say, kind of advise their clients and thus monetize this insider information. I mean, that is both a disaster in the particular, but it's also a broader cultural problem, isn't it? It suggests suggests something really dark.
Well, and also when you read the emails, they have such a disparaging approach to the ATO and Treasury, which I found really shocking. I'll give him a call and find out exactly what date the law will become law. They had people they felt were on tap to them within the public sector, and absolutely boastful about the opportunities for themselves, which, it curdles your gut. It's really upsetting to think people have captured really significant institutions and took 8 years to play out. You know, we now know, many of us, much more than we ever thought we would about the Tax Practitioners Board, for example, which is where, you know, this actually finally a crunch point came and someone paid a price. Peter Collins lost his tax agent status for 2 years and PwC was told to train its staff in ethics. Can you believe? I mean, it's incredible.
Mm. I mean, I think that's actually the interesting flip side to this whole story, right, which is proper processes set up by government in effect to, I assume, protect privacy or to protect the commercial interests of business entities or whatever. But can you kind of explain for listeners like how that actually worked against this scandal becoming public?
Well, I now have in my head, having listened to a number of days of evidence and really a lot of evidence in estimates, I have a vision of our tax machinery as being a series of silos. You know, there's a silo in Treasury that sets policy. There's a silo within the ATO that does the mechanics of tax collection. There's the Tax Practitioners Board over here with a piece of legislation about how they're meant to license tax advisors. Then there's, you know, a board of taxation over here offering a bit of policy. There's all these kind of silos of behaviour and action, none of which talk effectively to each other. And where are the ministers? Where is the government in this? We're told no one told the Treasurer anything at any point until the 22nd of December last year. I find that very hard to believe. But beneath that, across these silos of tax mechanics and architecture, they say they were prevented by secrecy provisions from, for example, sharing. Clearly they had concerns about key people. Tax had concerns about people within PwC, Peter Collins' name, for example, on a confidentiality agreement. Too slow. The mechanics were broken, and we need to fix a lot of that stuff. And I think it's on the government's agenda to do it.
So is there a consensus amongst the committee about how that should be done, or is this really something that the government will take forward? Are there differences of opinion?
Look, at the moment, this is my feeling, is there is absolute unanimity about this is a terrible scandal and it reveals a lot of weakness in the architecture of tax. And more broadly, how have we grown this industry of consulting, tax and audit to a multi-billion dollar operation and eroded our public sector so seriously? We haven't got down into the nitty-gritty of reform, though I've got some very clear ideas, and I'm sure others do too. But every time we go to kind of consider where to go further, we find a new scandal emerging. You know, we're hearing of some really extraordinary practices emerging through assertive, excellent journalism, bringing to the fore the fact that, you know, in the case of the education sector, PwC was both advising on policy level regulation as well as buying up equity in firms that were subject to that regulation. So people privately profiting, essentially a form of insider trading. Mm. There's a whole lot of issues that I have found deeply shocking, actually, so unethical.
Senator, can I just invite you to tease out the reform ideas that you at least are starting to form on this? It sounds, listening to you, that a lot of the problem here goes to transparency. We do have specialist agencies like the Tax Practitioners Board that can, you know, obviously have, you know, a specialist focus on what they focus on, and another body might be doing something else, and you need to connect them up. They need to be transparent enough to be able to share with themselves, let alone the Minister of the Day. It is alarming that the Treasurer of the Day, Josh Frydenberg it was, wasn't or arguably couldn't even be told about some of what was going on. What sort of reform, what sort of change can deliver the sort of transparency that we need? Yes, you know, government's talking about winding back the use of consultants and so on, but they're still going to be there. Is there a need that if they take on government work, they need to be accountable to even Senate committees like your own?
Mm. A very interesting question, David. I mean, that's really where we need to go. But just before we go to fixing things for the future, I do think we need to talk seriously about punishment for recent events. Mm. And so far, we've got pretty light touch consequences for PwC. Sure, they're suffering. They're losing government contracts hand over fist. And that is a massive challenge to their business model. But so far, a widespread scandal within their 900 group of partners has not had consequences. And my view is that they should have their tax registration status, because that's where the rot was, removed for a couple of years, and a serious consequence for them as a partnership. There's been a fall guy strategy there, where Peter Collins has taken the rap, but there is a massive problem within that organisation. And without consequences, what are we saying to people in the future about this kind of behaviour? We really need to have people pay attention to a financial penalty, and there hasn't been one yet.
Well, now they're selling off the government arm of their business, right?
Exactly. And that is we can talk about that, but just before we go
to that.
Got
a good price for it, at least, $1.
$1. Yeah, I mean, we need some consequences. And you know, that there are criminal acts in here. There need to be criminal penalties. This is the equivalent of, you know, what ordinary mortals, you or I, would pay major fines, possibly face a jail term if we did serious tax fraud. Well, there are no consequences yet there. So that needs to be cleaned up. Looking to the future, there's a bunch of things I think we need to do. Certainly need to allow tax policing structures to talk to each other and to have a responsibility to take this kind of behaviour to their minister and to the government. It shouldn't be allowed to fester. And I am really concerned about a culture beyond fixing, you know, the structure, a culture of don't ask, don't tell. I think we definitely had signs of that between tax, certainly, and
so between the public sector and the private sector, for example,
yeah,
in that
and
relationship.
Within the public sector.
And across
I feel
it, yeah.
Like, you know, there no doubt were people who were very concerned about what they thought was probably happening, but it was kept pretty quiet. And, it, you know, to decide not to tell the minister that major fraud was underway is really a bad decision, and we should be enabling that rather than preventing it from following through. We need to look at the secrecy provisions, and the government is doing that to try and enable a more open consideration of poor behaviour or when things have gone off the rails. I also think there's some big issues here about breaking the link between being a consultant to government and at the same time being a donor. There's a perception of conflict of interest, if not, you know, there's not brown bags of money changing hands here. We're not that kind of democracy yet. Let's hope we never are. But there certainly are challenges where, you know, these consultants give quite a bit of money and non-direct money as well through events and other forms of sponsorship. So I think we need to break. If you're a consultant to government, I don't think you should be a donor.
Yeah.
To political
just
process.
Like if you're a developer in some states, for example, you can't do that. Yeah. Do you harbour concerns about the possibility of this dysfunctional or this nefarious culture existing beyond PwC?
Absolutely. I can show you volumes of whistleblower.
Are you getting whistleblower information about
Absolutely.
Other members of the Big
yes.
Four?
Absolutely. With specific examples. And what we're looking at is conglomerates with a built-in structural conflict of interest.
And what happens now? Does that mean that you refer those to whatever it is, the tax registration board, or do you take up this as a parliamentarian?
These conflicts of interest that I'm talking about within the Big Four and the Big Seven are not of the kind that of tax, misusing confidential tax information. That was a very
but we
specific-
don't. But presumably, you don't know that similar things aren't going on.
Yes, that is true. Yeah. That is true. But we are very aware, and they're on the public record. For example, in KPMG, a famous case in the New South Wales government around the valuation of railway assets in the Tahi case. And the other egregious example in KPMG was the cheating of 1,100 of their staff on ethics testing over 4 years, which resulted in a massive fine in the US. The behaviour occurred in Australia, but it was never punished by our regulatory machinery in Australia. So there are some really significant. We've heard evidence already on that from KPMG as a Senate committee, and the internal conflicts of interest. There are many examples of them. So I think we have got some structural problems around the partnership model. It's way less transparent than a corporate model. Partnerships are required to show to the Australian public their revenue, but they aren't held accountable about a whole range of other matters like proper governance, how they reward and remunerate their managers. It's very opaque governance, And I'm reading a lot in my mailbox about what that does to the internal culture of big organisations. Whistleblowers have a very tough time. They are driven out, and the partnership's interest, this is what I'm hearing from people. I've never worked in one of these companies, but, you know, it really matters the kind of, for honesty about practice, that, you know, you have ways of dealing with matters like unethical behaviour. So, yes, I am concerned about all of these big companies, and it's a global problem. It's not just a problem in Australia. In 2013, the British Parliament had a very similar unethical tax breach by the Big Four, each of them, in using tax information to advise clients on avoiding tax. So, you know, it's a big problem, but, you know, we like to think of ourselves as a well-governed country, and these Big Four and their relationships with government and their internal conflicts of interest, their value for money, they're not well-governed in my view.
Senator Pocock, can I just throw you a question without notice now, changing subject, because I know you have to go. And I just thought I'd invite you to reflect on the fact that yesterday, as we record this, was the 10-year anniversary of Julia Gillard's departure as Prime Minister. And I wonder whether you have any thoughts about how history looks at her Prime Ministership now, but also, I suppose, whether, you know, what has changed in that decade since? Mm.
Oh, Mark, that's such a big question.
It is. I know. I'm sorry
really
to throw it to you without
especially
notice.
Especially after the last 2 weeks in Parliament. I'm particularly thinking about the awful events around assault and the failure of our Parliament to really still properly manage, and that we still see events in recent years of assault of women and poor handling of the consequences of it. And I know that's not what Julia's Gillard's prime ministership was about. She did many things. But when I look at it through the lens of recent years, this last decade, I see a woman and a leader who suffered a terrible price of misogyny. And I think, you know, as a country, my goodness, what a lost peer leadership and a price we've paid for our culture in politics. You know, and I sat there in Parliament last fortnight thinking, how far have we really come? You know, there is now, you know, an authority, PWSS, for women to go to if they are harassed inside Parliament House. But, you know, I was really sorry and sad that odour of the mistreatment of women still affects people inside the chamber. Now, Julia Gillard and her legacy are not only about that matter, but that was on my mind, I have to say, reflecting on the last decade and recent weeks.
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of summing it up. It's almost as if Julia Gillard, we sort of opened a box, but we still haven't actually sorted out all the ugly things within it.
Yeah.
Barbara Pocock, thanks so much for being with us on Democracy Sausage. There's a number of other things that we'll have to talk with you about another time. The relationship between the Greens and the Labor Party, which has been sort of fractious at times. Perhaps it's a little more civil in the Senate than it is in the House at the moment.
We're very civil.
Yes, that's right. yes, I've seen some of the civility just lately in the Senate. Yes, I'm not sure I would have called it that. Thanks so much for being with us again on Democracy Sausage, and we'll look forward to talking to you again another time.
Thanks, Senator.
Thanks, Mark, Maria, and David. Bye.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back to Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University. Now, before we go on and talk about some other things and pick up one or two of the themes we were talking about there with Barbara Pocock, let me just ask you this question. Do you know any inspiring ANU alumni who deserve recognition for their achievements? Nominations for the 2023 ANU Alumni Awards are closing soon. In fact, I think within days. So you can nominate someone who has inspired you, or if you've got a great story to share, nominate yourself. We'd love to hear it. We're particularly keen to see nominations in the Indigenous Alum of the Year and the current student volunteer categories. ANU alumni are leaders in Australia and around the world, and this is a great opportunity to highlight their achievements. Category finalists are invited to the awards presentation night in November. It's a very, very salubrious thing. Search for ANU Alumni Awards or click the link in the show notes here to nominate, and really would encourage you to do that. Nominations for these awards close at midnight on Tuesday, 4th of July. So that's probably not far away, depending on where you're listening. It may even be yesterday. Hopefully not. I have with me Dr. Maria Tafaga and David Spears, and we've just been talking before with Barbara Pocock, the Greens Senator, about the PwC matter mostly. I guess that, you know, raises a number of different questions, that whole issue, and we've covered it a fair bit. But just, what about on Julia Gillard? It's interesting thinking back 10 years. I was thinking back earlier, we all were, about Simon Crean's contribution, but, you know, 10 years since Julia Gillard left that job, Maria, It was, as you were saying, a tumultuous period for Labor, both in opposition and then in government. And that really, that tumult was really the sort of biggest characteristic, the defining weakness, really, of that period for Labor. The instability, the factionalism, the competition, the scheming, and the leadership changes that resulted from it, of which she was initially a beneficiary and then quite quickly, really, in historical terms, a victim.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was an absolutely exhausting time.
Yeah. Demoralizing too.
Yeah, absolutely. I always thought, I mean, because I was working as a researcher in the gallery at that time, and I was there when she resigned, and I still remember what she said, which was that gender doesn't explain everything, but it doesn't explain nothing. And I think that remains actually a really apt description of her time as Prime Minister. And, you know, there was all of that Lady Macbeth imagery around her. And one of the things that, and, you know, and I mean, like, yes, she was ambitious and, you know, quite clearly she made a call which she might have regretted at some points. I'm sure she doesn't now, because that doesn't seem to be like her style. Mm. But one of the things that I found really interesting about that whole time is that if she had been a man, I think Rudd would have just been considered a sore loser. And we kind of sort of see that with the sort of leadership ructions before and after, right, where, you know, a rival who was so repudiated. I mean, you know, he didn't even contest that ballot in the end, because I think he realised he really couldn't pull together more than 15 votes or a very small number of votes in a party which he had delivered office to after 11 and a half years of opposition, which kind of goes to some of the claims about the dysfunction of his office and his ability or inability to build a collegiate team, right? You know, I mean, that was sort of some of the substance of the claim. And the other half of it is, as you kind of say, right, like this sort of heightened palace court like drama with actors like who we don't talk about now, who may or may not be working at Crown still, like Mark Arbib, Sam Dastyari. I mean, Don Farrell is still there, right? But otherwise, you know, like it sort of was the sort of triumph of machine politics over, I suppose, thinking about kind of governance. And I think the final kind of interesting lesson from it all, I suppose, is how Labor has chosen to act now. I suppose how much space there is now for female-coded issues to actually be considered core policy, which, you know, Gillard herself has a patchy record on, which I think reflects the operating environment that she was operating in. Mm. Like the space actually had to be created to legitimize the care economy as a legitimate area of public policy that is not like a fringe issue.
I think that's really beautifully put. And it's interesting, isn't it, in that context, David, that you know, she was the prime minister who bumped single parents back onto the lower unemployment rate, a decision that's now been substantially reversed. But it was a real kind of seen at the time as hardly the act of a feminist inclined prime minister.
No, and there was also the refusal to support same-sex marriage,
indeed,
as well. And look, some of these were a reality of the political constraints that she was constantly under. It is interesting to think back on that period, you know, the 10 years since that period, what's changed. I mean, look, another policy thing often gets forgotten a little that she really championed, I think compared to where Labor is now, is the Gonski education reforms as well. And in her post-prime ministerial life, this is education and particularly educating girls and women has been a big part of a pretty stellar post-prime ministerial period for Julia Gillard. But nowadays, Labor is a little reluctant, perhaps a little hamstrung by the budget situation to go anywhere near as far as Julia Gillard wanted to go on education. I do think what's changed in the 10 years since, obviously there's the big issue is the misogyny and whether how she was treated would still happen today. I'm quite loath as a man to weigh in on whether life has really changed that much for women in politics. I do think some things, though, like the famous, anti-carbon tax rally with the Ditch the Witch and Bob Brown's bitch signs, I don't think you would see that today. I don't think, if you did, I think the reaction to it would be very different today. It was criticised at the time, but I think today it would be of another scale.
I think it's the kind of thing that would end careers now, whereas, you know, back then it was just par for the course.
Yeah, and the misogyny speech she gave, and Mark, you'd remember this well too, at the time it was very much viewed through the prism of what was going on with Peter Slipper and Julia Gillard defending Peter Slipper and putting him in as... to shore up the numbers, putting him in as speaker, all the scandals around him at the time. And
the
so
Craig Thompson matter that had been burbling along as well.
Yeah, it wasn't seen for what it became.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably fair to say about Julia Gillard's prime ministership. It wasn't seen at the time for what we now reflect on it as.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think the media's performance was pretty patchy. I mean, the weakness, journalism is often described as the first draft of history.
Mm. And it doesn't always get it right.
It doesn't always get it right, and it stands very close as a practice to those events, right, both temporally, that is in time, but also in space. I mean, you have to basically churn it out without really having a dialogue with the Australian people, seeing how issues are being received and understood to understand their kind of political weight. So a lot of judgments are made about it. And I think the judgment around the misogyny speech, for example, initially did see it in terms of the intrigue and machinations of Parliament and where the government was. But I do also think there was an incredibly coarse and aggressive discourse that was run in some sections of the media, which was very much a function of Gillard's gender.
I remember she was pursued for the bathroom renovations or something on that house.
It went on and on. And even before that, I think perhaps even before she was leader, there was the picture of her in her house in
the empty fruit bowl,
as if this was some sort of metaphor for her being childless. It was really appalling, and a lot of men just didn't understand, I think, all of these little signals and dog whistles and didn't understand why people were getting upset about them.
I think they actually just reproduced them,
Like,
I mean, her prime ministership was sort of seen, I think, by a lot of people in society as an aberration and that things would get back to normal afterward, And I think one of the other sort of interesting things to sort of reflect on at the time, you talk about the first draft of history, and I think that's one of the things that has actually been taken forward, which is at the time kind of treating her neutrally or fairly was kind of seen as the sort of correct or right thing to do. But in effect, all what it actually did was reproduce misogyny, right, and allow the outright outrageous framings from some parts of the political debate to have not to have a counter, I suppose, and that's something that she herself, I think, has felt that she had miscalculated on as well.
Yeah.
I think one more point too on that Gillard prime ministership that perhaps Anthony Albanese has learned from with some caution as well is remember the carbon tax signing ceremony with Bob Brown.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this on Insiders on the weekend.
Indeed,
it goes to Labor's current reluctance. Yes, they have to deal with the Greens. They need the Greens to get things through the Senate.
But you won't
constantly
see any joint press conferences.
But, yeah, yes, the Gillard government got a lot of things done, but did they last? The big stuff, no.
A lot of it, no.
Because they didn't have that longevity. Anthony Albanese wants to have longevity for Labor in this government. He'd like to be there as Prime Minister for as much of it, I'm sure, as possible. But that means being far more cautious in how they deal with the Greens in the Senate.
Yeah, and if you notice, he calls them the Greens political party.
Yeah, the GPP.
All the time, right? You know, which is basically a
student
rhetorical.
Politicians and...
Yeah, it's a rhetorical, like, sneering.
Well, it's a reminder. What he's,
your
what,
politicians
he's,
too.
He's, yeah, he's long been of the view that they've got away with calling them, you know, but being called the Greens, and that their whole presentation has got away with being sort of anti-politics, anti-establishment. And he's saying, no, you're playing the angles just like everyone else. You're looking at your electoral margins of advantage and speaking to your constituencies in ways that you think are going to maximise your electoral returns. And it is interesting because all political parties do that. Mm. And we know that Greens now have holdings in the lower house that, you know, they've quadrupled their holdings from 1 to 4 in the recent election. And it's going to be interesting to see. We already see a much more aggressive presentation from the Greens in that lower house. You have to, as I've said on this podcast a number of times, you have to actually attract a much wider slice of the vote in a lower house seat than you do to pick up a Senate quota across a whole state. And so it brings about a different kind of politics. And this is direct competition now with Labor in the inner cities. Mm. And Albanese in Grindler and Plibersek in the seat of Sydney and others, they all know this. They feel the Greens breathing down their neck in these inner city seats, and I think this is a real fight. And when, you know, we're not seeing any backward steps, and I agree with you. I don't think we'll see any joint press conferences or sort of formalised agreements.
Elevating the Greens,
yeah, that's right. The one final thing I'll say on Gillard though, is that she's the standout for the post prime ministerial performer.
100%.
She's gracious. She's productive.
Yep.
Constructive.
She's involved, of course, in the Global Institute for Women's Leadership here at ANU, but also based at King's in London. And she has essentially stayed out of the fray. You remember Malcolm Turnbull's term of, when he was going out the door saying some prime ministers are like miserable ghosts. I don't think you could say that about Gillard in any way. Notwithstanding that she left with in intensely rancorous circumstances. So, points for that.
It's kind of actually amazing how little she has effectively taken personally, given her prime ministership was so deeply personal.
It was. It was under siege, really, for the whole time.
Yeah. It really was, internally and without. I mean, do we want to talk a bit more about the Greens and Labor, or do we want to talk about something else?
Well, if you want to make some points about that, do so. I would like to get on to Ukraine and Russia
So on the Greens and Labor, right? Yeah, this is a really interesting kind of change in their relationship, which is clearly going through, you know, an evolution, because the reality is that the structure of the electorate is probably not going to see parties increasingly form majority governments unless they fiddle with the electoral system, right? So, but they hate each other. And one of the ways we like to think about what parties do is we have this framework called policy office votes, which works better when you've got coalitions. And we can kind of see what the Greens are doing, right? Like, so on climate, they really pursued policy. They wanted that policy outcome. But on this stuff around renters, it really is about votes. It's about speaking to that constituency of young people, even if, it's not kind of clear to me whether or not the Greens genuinely in their heart of hearts believe that a rent freeze is actually possible, implementable, or possibly even effective. But it's not really about that. Mm. It's about building.
Signaling.
Exactly. And that's why it's frustrated Labor so much, because it actually doesn't exist in the world of policy. It's not actually really very easy to implement from the federal sphere. And then there's lots of questions over its actual efficacy, but it is a very kind of effective, I think, politically. And considering the amount of visceral anger amongst that cohort, I don't think it matters if Labor says it's not implementable. that group of people wants to hear someone say, I want to smash this system.
Yeah, and I want to be represented.
Your interests.
Yeah.
Precisely. Right. And I think, you know, the reality of how we have talked about housing, it really hasn't represented this cohort. So it will be really interesting to see how Labor kind of treats that. I don't think, you know, rational arguments is going to fully cut it.
Yeah,
it's
really well put. I think that really nails where things are at. And I'm interested to hear from both of you whether you think Labor's found the right line on renters.
Well, I think they've found the orthodox line, but this is where I think there is a big weakness, and that is that Labor and the general sort of mainstream and conservative line is that a thing like a rent freeze is a distortion in a market that will have, a deleterious effects. The trouble is there are already distortions in this market, and they've been baked in for a long time in favour of home ownership and multiple home ownership mm-hmm. at that. And I think that needs to be actually recognised. This is not a level playing field. And I think a party stepping up and saying, we represent renters and we're going to start aggressively pursuing their interests, irrespective of what you say about what it will, you know, that it's a market distortion or whatever. Personally, I think there's a moral and electoral logic to that position. It's a competition with the status quo, but the status quo is rigged already.
Exactly. It's not like the status quo is actually logical or rational or fair, you know.
It's cultural. That's what it is.
Precisely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and look, I don't know where Labor can take this, because it is true that a lot of this rests with the states and territories, and look, they can talk about strengthening renters' rights and encouraging the states to do that, and, you know, that process is underway. But they are also boxed in on the things they can do, negative year-end capital gains tax reform. They boxed themselves in.
Yeah, they did.
So much now on that that it's hard to see how they find a new line on this, because I think you're absolutely right. This is a real danger for them in all of these seats. Renters have had enough. Yeah, the Greens have tapped into that very cleverly.
Because the thing about renters is they don't have much money as a cohort and they don't have any power. You know, they don't have any power in their relationship with their landlord, really. It's an asymmetrical power relationship. And they, at the moment, don't have any real political power. They're not part of the Australian dream, the Australian ethos as we've constructed it. And the Greens are saying, well, we're gonna stand for you. And it's smart, in my view. Mm. And they're not going to worry about the details too much. I think we were saying this the other day as well. They're not going to worry about the details too much, whether there's an argument about whether it can be done or can't be done, because while ever there is an argument raging about representing renters' interests, then the Greens, I think, are moving forward politically.
Exactly. Because that's what people are going to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Let's just very quickly, because we're running quite long today, but we've had such good discussions. Mm. Let's just quickly touch on whatever the hell happened in Russia. I've been talking with a couple of political scientists here over the last couple of days. No, but there is sort of, you know, there's a degree of cynicism about what it is that we know about it so far and who actually ends up being the beneficiary of it. And I guess a couple of the people I've spoken to are trying to avoid wishful thinking, and so talking about it as possibly being.
I was talking to someone pretty senior in government last night. From the Australian government's point of view, they still think Vladimir Putin is still very much in charge. But I think there is a lot of head scratching. You look at Joe Biden's comments, European leaders' comments. I don't think anyone is terribly clear about where things stand.
Things are clearly very opaque. And I mean, I think the simplest potential explanation of what is going on here is that Prigozhin, that's the warlord, right, has made this ambient claim for power, possibly, clearly in coalition with someone, right, or he's completely mad, and they haven't stepped up and left him exposed. But why that has happened is, you know, the stuff of, like, you know, murky Game of Thrones politics kind of stuff, right? Like, is it that it's about his rivals in other parts of government? Because Prigozhin is Putin's creature, right? And so the fact that he has publicly moved against the president is really damaging for Putin's prestige.
Well, he says he hasn't. He says he's moved against the defence minister and that he never, I mean, there's a little bit of post facto explanation.
Absolutely.
Of it,
and a lot of like post justification. And it's kind of interesting that that deal struck between like Lukashenko and Putin, who hate each other as well, right? So I actually think it is really damaging to Putin's prestige that Lukashenko has brokered this deal in the first place, that, you know, Putin has come out and sort of said, like, this is like the 1917 revolution. This is a stab in the back. Like, this is really emotive
language. And these traders will pay, you know.
And then like, oh, I'm going to, you know, none of them will be punished. But now this morning is that they are going to be punished. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, there's probably a clock on Prigozhin's life. Like, let's face it.
Couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Like, oh, well, yeah. But it, I mean, I feel like this is the end of Act Two.
Yeah.
Right? Like this has there's a lot of implications that will ripple as a result of this. And whilst I think Putin is absolutely still in control, his hegemonic status is clearly weakened. You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He's weakened by this. Yeah. The case for the war is weakened by Prigozhin calling that out.
Absolutely.
And what, you know, what this does to, well, I guess most immediately, the morale of the frontline troops, be they Russian or Wagner mercenaries, you'd have to think that's absolutely shaken. The Russian people and the Russian elite in particular, their confidence in Putin must be rattled by all of this. I think the immediate fear is, what does Putin do to show strength? What does he do to demonstrate he is still very much in charge? That's the fear.
Yeah.
Yeah. In 30 seconds, did we do enough with our latest tranche of aid for Ukraine? It's about $110 million worth of you know, vehicles and so forth, but they've been described as old vehicles.
Yeah, there's been a fair bit of criticism. Look, some of the vehicles are pretty old, the M113 troop carriers. Special operations vehicles will be welcome. The trucks will be welcome. The ammunition will be welcomed. Obviously, Ukraine is going to still want more.
They want Hawkeyes. They want Abrams tanks.
Look,
and
from what
they,
I understand,
they want F-16s.
The Hawkeyes, there's a couple of issues there. The braking mechanism, the parts, they can't easily be replaced. Defence has said, not a great. Look, the idea with a Hawkeye, it's kind of like, if your tank is at one end of the spectrum, your Hawkeye is kind of at the other. It's light. It'd be hell of a lot of fun to drive that around, right? Mm. It's zippy, but not very well protected. If it gets hit by something, forget it. It's game over. They're meant to be carried around on the battlefield by a Chinook helicopter and dropped in. That's not how Ukraine wanted to use them. So anyway, they'll keep asking for more. You can understand that. They're in a war. This is existential for them.
Yeah.
They're going to keep demanding more. Australia will keep providing more. I think this is it for now. Yes, some criticism that it's not enough. You know, this is just another step. It's going to keep going, isn't it?
It just worries me, though, that, you know, the performance of a number of different allies supporting or countries supporting Ukraine are sort of eking out their, you know, they're promising assistance, but that assistance is slow to come and comes in relatively small increments. And it allows the West to facilitate Ukraine's survival in the fight. One wonders whether it allows the Ukrainians, whether it facilitates the Ukrainians actually decisively winning it, and whether speeding up, even if not increasing dramatically, the amount of aid.
Particularly now.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't have air support, and so they'll actually be facing exactly the same kinds of difficulties, but without air support that the Russians faced, right? You need 3-1 at least to win an offensive war. The Ukrainian government themselves have said that this counteroffensive this year is really phase one.
Mm.
So they know they need those.
Yeah, it's turned out to be a much longer fight than a number of people, including, no doubt, Vladimir Putin and
he's like 400 days into his three-day war.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Look, been an absolutely terrific discussion, as always. Thanks to both of you again. Really, really enjoyed that. And thanks also to Barbara Pocock, who we had in the first half. That's Democracy Sausage for this week. You can contact us on our email, which is democracysausage@anu.edu.au. And if I slow down on that, it's because I always get it wrong. That's it for now. We'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Bye for now.
Thank you.
when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.